Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Trump has lashed out at Democrats overseeing an impeachment inquiry, AP's Sagar Magani reports. And British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Wednesday made a final Brexit offer to the European Union, including his plans for the Irish border, but most other details are scarce. North Korea said on Thursday that it had successfully test-fired a new weapon, a submarine. It's a ballistic missile from the sea to contain external threats and bolster self-defense ahead of fresh nuclear talks with the United States. The launch on Wednesday was the most provocative by the North since it resumed dialogue with the United States in 2018, and a reminder by Pyongyang of the weapons capability it has been aggressively developing. And again, President Trump lashes out at Democrats overseeing an impeachment inquiry.
In the Oval Office and then the East Room, with Finland's leader by his side, the president was visibly angry at House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff.
They should look at him for treason.
Democratic rival Joe Biden.
Biden and his son are stone cold crooked.
And reporters who pressed him on the probe.
You know who's playing into the hoax? People like you.
The president did not say yes or no when asked if he'd cooperate with a House request for documents on Ukraine. Schiff said earlier Congress would not look kindly on any more stonewalling.
Will be considered as evidence of obstruction.
And also warned the president against any efforts to intimidate the whistleblower at the probe's heart or any other witnesses. Sagar Magani at the White House.
And this is VOA News. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson made a final Brexit offer to the European Union, including his plans for the Irish border, but not many other details. We get more from Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda.
In a public letter to EU leadership, the Prime Minister calls for a regulatory zone to span the entire island, both Northern Ireland and the Republic, which will govern all trade goods. To avoid border checks, he says a declaration system would be introduced for small business traders, along with a trusted traders program to speed up the process. Johnson's border plans, if approved by the EU and British Parliament, would replace the so-called backstop proposals, which played a role in sinking his predecessor, Theresa May's government. Johnson has vowed to bring the UK out of the EU, deal or no deal, by October 31st.
That is Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda reporting. At a memorial marking a year since journalist Jamal Khashoggi's murder shocked the world, his fiancée is still asking what happened exactly and who was responsible.
A memorial started at the time 1 year ago. The Washington Post columnist walked into the consulate, never to return. Post owner Jeff Bezos pointed out Khashoggi was getting documents so he could marry Hatice Cengiz.
You are in our hearts. We are here, and you are not alone.
Cengiz was waiting for Khashoggi outside the consulate on that day.
After a worst year in my life, I stand here, broken but proud.
1 year later, she wants answers.
What happened to his body?
Saudi Prince Mohammed says he takes full responsibility for Khashoggi's death, but denied he ordered it. I'm Ed Donahue.
Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders leaving the campaign trail and until further notice after undergoing surgery for a blocked blood vessel near his heart. Seven people were killed, several others were injured when a World War II vintage B-17 airplane crashed at an airport near Hartford, Connecticut on Wednesday. The so-called Flying Fortress experienced some type of problem shortly after takeoff and was trying to return to Bradley International Airport when it crashed. Again, seven people were killed. Several other people were injured when that World War II vintage plane crashed. More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October the 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe's main opposition leader outlines the way out of the country's current political and economic crisis.
We have said the political crisis in this country can only be sorted out when we have resolved the politics of our country.
Nelson Chamisa is the leader of the opposition movement for democratic change. Uganda's Bobby Wine tells supporters to defy a ban on wearing the People Power Movement red beret. Morocco aims to become the gateway to increased U.S. investment in Africa. And the Liberian diaspora is not happy with a dual citizenship bill awaiting President George Weah's signature.
I want to seize this opportunity to call on the President of the Republic of Liberia to allow that bill to die naturally on its way to his office. It is not in the best interest of his government, and it is not in the best interest of the Liberian people.
Arthur Weadoo is the National Secretary of the Union of Liberian Associations in the Americas, and the Tunisian women hope to secure a gender parity vote in this Sunday's legislative election. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Zimbabwe, the leader of the main opposition movement for democratic change has again said solving the country's economic problems rests on first dealing with the country's current political impasse. Nelson Chamisa reiterated that he won last year's presidential election, not President Emmerson Mnangagwa. In his State of the Nation address on Tuesday this week, President Mnangagwa pleaded for time and patience to bring the country's struggling economy back from the dead. But in this exclusive interview with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service, Chamisa says President Mnangagwa failed to articulate solutions to Zimbabwe's many problems.
We would expect under these circumstances where we have shortages of everything that there would be an adequate and articulation of what the solutions are around electricity, energy, around the almost impossible school fees, around transport costs that are skyrocketing, the prices that are going up in the shops, around issues to do with fuel shortages, around issues to do with basically the hardship that people are going through. But more fundamentally, around the political challenges that have to be sorted out in this country.
They say it's easy to criticize. What is the MDC offering?
Any State of the Nation address that does not speak to the current abductions, the current human rights abuses, issues to do with Dr. Makompei, you know, the abduction and the circumstances around his health, issues that do not address what happened to Gonyet, one of our, you know, artists who was also abducted, MDC activists, members of parliament who have been arrested, the political situation that is deteriorating, issues to do with pariah status and state that our country is currently is a state of the national address which is actually not indicating where the country is going. In fact, Mr. Mnangagwa was giving us his state of the mind instead of giving us the state of the nation. And his mind is clearly showing that there's disorder, there is turmoil, there is chaos, and there is no solution. We have said the political crisis in this country can only be sorted out when we have resolved the politics of our country. It is politics, stupid. Until and unless we have resolved the fundamental issue of reaching a national consensus on what the problems are, we will not move forward. Legitimacy, legitimacy, legitimacy. There can never be economic reconstruction until we are able to come together and say this is the nature of our problem and this is the national consensus as to the answer to that problem.
But your critics are saying you and Mr. Mnangagwa are talking over each other. You are all saying you want dialogue. But why is it not happening? Why are you not taking the lead to engage him?
It takes two to tango. I can't force Mr. Mnangagwa to dialogue with me. I've told him that the problem that needs to be resolved is a political problem. It requires political players and actors. The people of Zimbabwe voted in July of 2018. They indicated their broad preferences. We won the election emphatically, and that is beyond any dispute. Of course, we went to the Constitutional Court. The court decided otherwise. We respected the decision of the court, but that does not take away from the determination and verdict of the people, that the will of the people was very clear. Mr. Mnangagwa knows it. His lieutenants know it, that they did not win this election. And the fact that they did not win this election makes it more even the reason why we should be dialoguing.
Nelson Chamisa is the president of Zimbabwe's main opposition movement for democratic change. He spoke with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service in Harare. Ugandan parliamentarian Robert Chakulayi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, has told his supporters to defy a government ban on wearing the red beret, the official symbol of his people power movement. The Uganda People's Defense Forces claim their uniform includes a red beret and that civilians should not be allowed to wear it. They say anyone wearing it will be prosecuted. Joe Sinyonyi, the spokesman for Bobi Wine's People Power Movement, says wearing the red beret does not contravene any Ugandan law.
The banning of the beret as we are hearing it from government, really, it is a fear by President Museveni. He's in panic mode together with his regime. They are in fear of people power because people power has risen as the political wave that is shaking up his government and literally going to sweep him politically. And so they are trying to find all avenues to cut our speed, to slow us down. And one of those is to try and delegitimize our symbol, our emblem, if you like, and that is the red beret. There's a very distinction, if you like, between the UPDF beret and the People Power beret. The UPDF berets all have the UPDF badges, that's the only badge. The People Power berets have the People Power badges, because our laws talk about the marks and insignias of the UPDF of the army, and ours does not have that. And in fact, we are telling our people, anyone who tries to wear the UPDF beret itself with a badge, UPDF badge, that's wrong. But please keep wearing the People Power berets because you don't commit any offense.
But are you not concerned because the army said anyone wearing them will be prosecuted?
We are wearing them. We are continuously wearing them. We are waiting for them to arrest us and prosecute us. As far as we are concerned, we are not committing any offense. And look, we are telling our government to measure on measures and to minor on minors. They like to measure minors and minor on measures. And so we are telling them, instead of wasting so much time and resources hunting down people who are wearing red berets, go and hunt down the people who are kidnapping Ugandans. I'm sure you follow our news here. Almost every other day, there is another young lady or another young man that has been kidnapped. Many of them eventually are found dead. And then so many other that are happening in Nazi society. And we're telling our government, put the focus on that. Hunt down the people who are killing Ugandans. Hunt down on the kidnappers and so on. Those are the real criminals.
It says that one will be tried in a military court for wearing a beret. This is very serious.
Whichever kind of court they want to use, civilian court, army court, state house court, God knows what courts, we are ready. We are not committing any offense, and so we are continuing to wear our red berets.
President Museveni, he has ordered the salaries of the science teachers and doctors to be increased. What's your reaction?
We have been saying, look, pay people better, pay teachers better, pay the army better, and all of these different things. And then so he's trying to buy the population back to his side by doing anyhow what he is supposed to do. And we believe it's because of the pressure we've exerted and the population has stand against him. And then so he's beginning to do a couple of things. The other thing that he did today, he issued a directive saying all the people that have been arrested for being idle and disorderly, vendors in the streets and all of these different people should be released. And all this we believe is because of the pressure that we have exerted. So an increment is a welcome move, and we are saying the same should go for folks in security forces, police and the army and all of that. It's a slight increase, and we are saying it can get better and it should get better.
Joe Sinyonyi is the spokesman for Ugandan parliamentarian Bobi Wine's People Power Movement. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Thursday, October 3rd, Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. An official of the Liberian diaspora in the United States is calling on President George Weah to kill a dual citizenship bill that is awaiting his signature because he said it is not in the development interest of Liberia. Both houses of the Liberian legislature passed a dual citizenship bill this week. According to the bill, any person whose parent was a citizen of Liberia at the time of that person's birth shall be a natural-born citizen of Liberia. The bill goes on to say a natural-born citizen of Liberia may hold the citizenship of another country but shall not qualify for elected positions in Liberia. Arthur Weado is the National Secretary of the Union of Liberian Associations in the Americas.
It is not in the interest of Liberians in the diaspora for the fact that when a country goes to war, when the country is struggling economically, it depends on its brilliant and professional pool living in the diaspora. But with the current bill stripping off all of the positions in government, including assistant minister and director, and I mean, it is so disheartening. So I think the effort of having dual citizenship is to contribute, having Nigerians in the diaspora, to will they be able to have their country develop from the outset.
I don't know, maybe this is how people in Liberia see it, because the legislators are responding to their constituencies. The view there is that perhaps Liberians in the diaspora, you only go back to Liberia, and they claim that when you go back, you are taking away jobs there.
I have visited Liberia nearly every year, and from what I gather, I feel that the people did not understand what is transpiring in their representatives. So the notion that we have, indeed, it is the Liberian people who do not want for their sons and daughters who left the country because of the Civil War to partake in government. It is far, far, far from being the truth, Mr. Bode.
I guess you have objection to the point that natural-born citizen of Liberia may hold the citizenship of another country, but you shall not qualify for elected positions. Is that the only thing that you're concerned about, first of all?
I'm not concerned about having jobs. I'm concerned about Liberians in the diaspora partaking in the body politics of their country. At this time in history, it is not only jobs. The private sector is open, but you want to something the playing field to encourage Liberians to be able to go to their country of birth and contribute willingly, not with some restrictions here and there.
Again, this law is not yet law because President Weah now has to sign it into law.
Absolutely. The bill that we are need to sign. That is why I want to seize this opportunity to call on the President of the Republic of Liberia to allow that bill to die naturally on its way to his office. Let him veto it. It is not in the best interest of his government, and it is not in the best interest of the Liberian people. That law is selfish, it is draconic, and it will not serve the purpose for which Liberia needs at this moment, where all aspects of its developmental initiatives are needed, and people need to see natural-born, well-spread daughter in the diaspora, natural-born to contribute to their country.
Arthur Weah-Do is the outgoing National Secretary of the Union of Liberian Associations in the Americas. Officials with the Moroccan Investment and Development Agency say Morocco aims to become the gateway for increased United States investment in Africa. Mavis Ocheri has more from Washington.
African nations received $46 billion in foreign direct investment in 2018, up to 11% in 2017 United Nations figures. Sure. Nejma Helhuda Bouamama is department chief of Moroccan Agency for Investment Department. She says the expansion of the country's Tangier net port would help her country become a key stop for investors and trading operations in Africa. Tangier net is the biggest port in Africa, and last year it handled 3.5 million 20-foot equivalent units of cargo. With the expansion, the figure is expected to rise sharply this year. Bouamama thus recalled for increased public and private sector exploration and trade investment in Morocco and Africa as a whole. She made the comments at an African investment forum at the World Trade Center in Washington. The forum strived to identify business opportunities and potential U.S. investments in Morocco and other African countries in sectors such as energy industry and finance.
We are eager to work for U.S. investments. It doesn't mean what U.S. can do in Morocco, Africa. Actually, we do have some U.S. investment, but it doesn't meet our goals and what because our relationship with U.S. are strong, are really good. So we think that we can do a lot with how to improve that, to do things better. But we should develop some good relationship here, as Ted communicates, more clear relationship, specific government to move forward. But we should let's say accelerate.
Mohamed Mukhtar also worked with the Business Development Department at Moroccan Investment and Development Agency. He says the country is strategically placed and have good infrastructure to serve different markets. He says the Moroccan government aims to diversify the economy to be resilient when economic problems hit.
We believe that we can be competitive. We can be what Mexico is to the United States in terms of car manufacturing. And the idea here is that we have succeeded to convince those constructors to establish their unit, production unit in Morocco. And around them, we have set different, what we call OEM, original equipment manufacturer, around them to supply their production chain. So besides that, we have very good, well-known car parts producers who are serving Peugeot, Citroën, and Peugeot, Citroën, Renault, and the other one. Mm-hmm. And they are serving also car manufacturers in Europe.
Among its advantages, Mukhtar says, is that Morocco has free trade agreements with the European Union and the United States and several other countries, so it can import and export goods and services without duties. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Washington.
Women have made huge strides in Tunisian politics since the country's 2011 revolution and are hoping to make further progress towards gender parity in legislative elections this Sunday. But building on or even sustaining the earlier gains may be a problem, as Lisa Bryan reports from Tunis.
It's hard to miss Samira Shawashi this election season. She appears widely in the media as spokesperson for the Heart of Tunisia party, headed by jailed presidential candidate Nabil Karoui. But Shawashi is also running her own race in Sunday's parliamentary vote, heading the party's Tunis area list. It's been a long road getting here.
There used to be a political quota for women before the revolution, but they weren't always the right ones for the job. Now it's much more about competence. You have to fight within your party to be a leader.
So we don't have any difficulty to find, women, female candidates, but to let the parties put them as head of list, that's the fight.
Tunisian women have long enjoyed rights rarely seen elsewhere in the Arab world. They captured nearly half of all seats in last year's municipal elections, and they make up nearly one-third of Tunisia's current parliament, compared to just one-fifth in the U.S. Congress. One big reason, laws requiring parity in party lists. Two women also ran for president this year. The capital, Tunis, has its first ever female mayor from the moderate Islamist Ennahda party. But women had less than 10% of Ennahda's list for these legislatives. There's no parity when it comes to ranking, and the party says it's hard to find good candidates.
We are unhappy, honestly, with the 10%. We'd like to do more, and hopefully in the future we'll do better.
Getting women out to vote is another challenge. Many are disappointed with post-revolution politics.
People are losing hope, and they are not so involved. They don't like to have another bad experience.
But Shawashi believes there's no going back. Tunisians are now comfortable electing women representatives, even if they may not yet be ready for a female head of state. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Tunis.
Teenage pregnancy is on the rise in Kenya as the country struggles to reduce maternal deaths caused mostly by young women securing unsafe abortions and miscarriages. According to the health ministry, use of contraceptives will help reduce the high mortality rate among young women between the ages of 15 and 24. Maureen Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
At least 40% of women in Kenya aged between 15 to 24 get unplanned pregnancy, which is mostly driven too by inadequate access to reproductive health, information and services, cultural and religious taboos, and poverty. Speaking during the launch of the Contraception Day in Nairobi, Kenya's Health Cabinet Secretary Cecil Kariuki said that meeting the demand for modern contraception and reproductive health is linked to the achievement of several sustainable development goals by allowing the participation of women in the labor force due to planned pregnancies.
I have a wish to reflect that despite of all these positive achievements, there's still issues that we need to cast our eyes towards and reflect upon. One is the increased teenage pregnancy, which continues to contribute in high maternal mortality and morbidity for this age set.
Use of contraceptives has been fought in Kenya by the Catholic Church as the government enacted the laws to have teenagers and young women have a right to access to health care. Ms. Kariuki says the health ministry is on the forefront to offer quality family planning methods to Kenyans.
Various counties already observed this important day by attending to various activities that all targeted offering quality family planning services to our people. This is indeed commendable, and today's event is further to augment the efforts already that have been made in the counties.
Cultural practices in Kenya are said to contribute significantly to weak implementation and monitoring of policy legislation. Tessa Matholi, the chairperson, Department of International Development under UKAID, said that millions have been spent to ensure easy access of family planning methods in Kenya.
At UNGA last week, the UN General Assembly meeting, we announced a new £600 million program to support access to family planning commodities, reproductive health commodities, which will be largely channeled through UNFPA. So that's the equivalent of 78 billion Kenyan shillings. So that's a global contribution for many poorer countries to be able to access family planning commodities, and should enable a further 20 million women and girls to access those commodities.
On the other hand, Ademola Olajide, representative from the United Nations Population Fund, said that countries should come up with strategies to grow the economy through healthy family planning methods.
As we all know, family planning is very critical to national development. It forms a central piece within the development agenda, enhancing the health of not only women and children, but the well-being of the family as a whole. And the family remains a critical unit, driving the human capital that is necessary for economic development within the national development agenda.
In Kenya, oppositions from religious and community leaders has often prevented young people from accessing the information and services that would enable them meet their sexual and reproductive health needs. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. In Zimbabwe, the leader of the main opposition movement for democratic change has again said that solving the country's economic problems rests on first dealing with its current political impasse. Nelson Chamisa reiterated that he won last year's presidential election, not President Emmerson Mnangagwa. In his State of the Nation address on Tuesday this week, President Mnangagwa pleaded for time and patience to bring the country's struggling economy back from the dead. But in this exclusive interview with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service, Chamisa says President Mnangagwa failed to articulate solutions to Zimbabwe's many problems. An official of the Liberian diaspora in the United States is calling for on President George Weah to kill a dual citizenship bill that is awaiting his signature because he said it is not in the development interest of Liberia. Both houses of the Liberian legislature passed a dual citizenship bill this week. And that's it for this Thursday, October 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Oh.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.